Well, there it was in high school. I was sitting in the library, and I had a cold sweat on my forehead, and I was nervous as all get out, and I was trying to sign into the library computer, and I had failed twice with my student password, which was a frequent occurrence. I don't remember why. I don't know if it was just because my password was hard to remember or it was the pressure, but at this point, I remember I was under great pressure because the librarian was standing right behind me, and after you failed three times to enter your password, you got locked out of the system, and so then the librarian had to come over, punch in his password, and you could get in. Now, that really shouldn't be that big of a deal because he just had to punch in a couple numbers you were in. I didn't even know why we needed a password anyway because it wasn't like members of the public in our small town were just showing up at the school library, but it was what we needed to do. And the reason I was so nervous was because our librarian was kind of a bitter, very grumpy guy. And so anytime anybody failed to log in, he would give him a really hard time and would tell him, what are you doing? How can you not know your password? It's really simple. And so I would get nervous when he was watching. And at this point, I knew he was right behind me. I was the only one in the library. And so he was just waiting for me to fail the third time. And so with that pressure, I was thinking, what is my name? How am I supposed to log in? Where am I even at? And so it's not fun being around bitter people. And the same librarian sometimes would kick people out of the library just because he didn't like them. So I saw this frequently because I was in the library for one of my study halls. So my senior year, I had many study halls. I tried to get over half of my schedule to be study halls, but the guidance counselor wouldn't let me do that because she said I had to go to college and stuff like that. And I was already in college, so I didn't see, I had been admitted, and I didn't see the need to take extra math and all that stuff, so I took as many as she let me take. And so one of those was in the library, and so I just signed in that I didn't have to sign in with my teacher. I could just go straight to the library, and so I did that. And I would usually be the only one in the library when the bell rang and the class started, and it would just be the librarian, his assistant, who happened to be my cousin, and then myself in there. And so I'd be in there reading whatever book I found interesting at the time, and a student would inevitably come in, and if the librarian didn't like this student, thought that this was kind of an ornery person or something like that, the student, the second they would walk in the door to sign in, he would say, "Library's full." And they would look up, and I'd look up, and I'm the only one in this whole library, and they would be like, "No, it's not. It's not full." And he'd say, "Library's full. Get out of my library." And he'd send him off, and I'd have the library to myself, which I was okay with, but I kind of felt bad for the other students. But it was all because he was kind of a bitter, grumpy guy. And I don't know what happened to make him bitter. I don't know if there was a tragedy or some event. I know he was married, and his wife was kind of similar. She was a substitute teacher, so I don't know what was going on there, but it was a very bitter family. Now, one thing that can make somebody bitter is they suffer tragedy. And maybe you've suffered a tragedy in life, and when you suffer tragedy, when we suffer tragedy or a hardship or a grief, or maybe you've had a family business that's been around forever and it goes under because of the economy, or somebody close to you dies, or you get a bad diagnosis of the doctor, when that happens, we're tempted to become bitter, aren't we? We start getting frustrated. We start getting not only depressed, but kind of angry. Maybe angry at God, maybe angry with ourselves. We become bitter. And if you know a bitter person, it's not real fun to be around them. It's kind of like that librarian. And maybe they become more of an angry Eeyore, if you know who I'm talking about. From Winnie the Pooh, right? Eeyore's always depressed, always upset, always pessimistic about everything. But maybe they become angry so that it's not only depression, but they are angry at God, angry at everybody else, angry at the world because they feel like God has abandoned them. So does God abandon us? That's the question I'm going to be addressing today. Does God abandon us? Does he give up on us? And so today we're going to continue our study out of Ruth. If you'll look with me at Ruth 1, 19 through 2, 3. And we're going to see the answer to that in our text today. Does God give up on us? Today we'll see a problem we face, a solution to the problem, and an application. So we should be looking for 3 points. You'll see that on your sermon insert outline if you want to look there and follow along with me. So first we'll read Ruth 1, 19 just through verse 22, and I'll stop there. Ruth 1:19 through 22, and then we'll get the rest of the passage later. And then we're also going to flip to Leviticus and Deuteronomy later on in the sermon. Ruth 1:19 through 22. So it says, so the two of them went on until they came to Bethlehem. And when they came to Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them. And the women said, is this Naomi? And she said to them, do not call me Naomi, call me Mara, for the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went away full, and the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi when the Lord has testified against me and the Almighty has brought calamity upon me? So Naomi returned, and Ruth the Moabite, her daughter-in-law, with her, who returned from the country of Moab. And they came to Bethlehem at the beginning of barley harvest. So the problem we see today that I want to talk about is when tragedy or hardship hits, we become bitter, or we're tempted to become bitter. Bitterness starts creeping into our lives, and we take up this bitter disposition. We see this with Naomi after the death of her husband and her sons. She became bitter. Now, last week where we left Naomi and Ruth. They are on the road to Bethlehem. They're on the way to Bethlehem, and now where we pick up, they are entering into Bethlehem. Now, remember at this point that Bethlehem is a small, pretty insignificant town, so hopefully I don't offend anybody here, but I think it's probably got kind of the reputation that Rossville has, largely if you travel outside of the area and you go other places in Indiana or in the nation. So if you go down south in Indiana, you go to Indianapolis, and somebody asks you where you're from, and you say, I'm from Rossville, Indiana. They're going to say, oh, okay, and they're probably not going to know where that is, right? Rossville is a small town. It's largely insignificant in the eyes of the state as a whole, and especially if you go, let's say, to New York or California, to another part of the nation, and they say, where are you from? And you say, I'm from Rossville, Indiana. They're not going to have any idea where that is, right? It's a small town, and especially if you're in California or New York, they may not even know where Indiana is, but that's a separate issue. So, like Rossville, Bethlehem at this time would have been a small town where everybody knows everybody, and this is also before internet, so they're not following along on the news, or they're not watching television and finding out, you know, what the latest politicians, what the judges are doing, or what scandals are going on, and there would have been plenty at this time in Israel's history, but it's a small, close-knit community, and whatever happens in the small town is big news. So here comes Naomi, back into town after 10 years being gone. And nobody that was with her when she left, her husband or her sons, are with her. She shows up alone, except for this Moabite girl. So this would have been the talk of the town. This would have been big news. This would have been, you know, if this had been in the days of social media, this would have been just the talk of the town. And so the women, look at verse 19, the women of the town exclaimed, is this Naomi? Is this the Naomi that lived with us 10 years ago with her husband and her two sons? And Naomi's response reveals her bitterness. She says in verse 20 not to call her Naomi, which is related to a word that means pleasantness or delightfulness or kindness, but to call her Mara, which refers to bitterness. Now, you'll see this in your Bibles if you look at the footnotes. You'll probably have a footnote there next to Naomi and Mara, and so this is a little digression, but a little plug for that. If you're reading your Bible and you see a little footnote, don't ignore that. Read that. That usually offers some help and a translation issue, something that helps you interpret Scripture. So don't ignore those. Look at those. And so this is a case there where we're seeing something about the meaning of the names. There's a purpose behind her wanting people to call her Mara instead of Naomi. So that's just a little plug for footnotes. Didn't think you were going to get that today, did you? But so she left pleasant and delightful. She left full. Not full of food, not full of possessions, because remember that's why they left and went to Moab, because they wanted to go somewhere where they had more food, where they could have their needs provided for, but she left full of family, and she's come back empty. Once again, looking for food, looking for needs to be met, and she doesn't have her family with her. And so she's bitter, and she's lost hope. Now look at the second sentence in verse 21. This has all happened because God was against her. At least that's how she perceives it anyway. If you know the story of Ruth, you know that it's not true that God was completely against her. We're going to see things turn around in the next few chapters. But she feels like God is completely against her. She understands God's sovereignty. In fact, I better prefer the translation of the HCSB, the NASB, and the King James. And it says that God afflicted Naomi. That's how Naomi perceives it. That's how she feels, that God is after her. She understands that if God is sovereign over all things, he's in control of all things, then he at least allowed this, if not that he's doing this to her. The word testify here has legal connotation. So in Naomi's eyes, God has judged her guilty. He's taken her family from her, and he's punishing her for something. And so it's all God's fault, and she's bitter. Because if God's against you, what hope do you have? So she's bitter, she's frustrated, she's kind of given up. And she wants people, she's so bitter, she wants people to call her Mara, bitter by name. She wants, not only because this bitterness is always in her mind, always the forefront of her mind, she not only wants to be reminded of her bitterness when people address her, but she wants them to be aware that she's bitter and that she's suffering as well. You've probably met people like that, right? Who just want you to know that they are suffering, want you to know that they are bitter and they're frustrated. And sometimes we're tempted to be like that too. We kind of have the attitude of, you know, if I can't be happy, if I'm in pain, everybody else needs to be unhappy too, and everybody else needs to be in pain as well. And it's no fun being around somebody bitter and frustrated like that. Naomi at this point is at her low point. She and Ruth are just trying to get by. And so they arrive at the beginning of barley harvest, which in our calendar is March of April, and they hope to be able to harvest and get some much-needed food, just provide for their basic necessities. Now, I say all this about Naomi, and not to put her down below any of us, because we also struggle with bitterness, don't we? When something happens to us, we suffer some kind of tragedy, sometimes we're tempted to think, you know, God just hates me. God doesn't like me. God is against me. It doesn't matter what I do, God is going to destroy my happiness. God is going to take away my joy. God is going to take away what I want most. And when something good happens or we have a blessing, we hold it kind of at arm's length and we think, I don't want to be happy about this. I don't want to embrace this. I don't want to enjoy this. I don't want to be thankful about this because God is going to take this from me. I'm going to suffer. God is against me. God hates me. And you fall into this bitterness, this kind of black hole where it sucks all joy, all blessing, all focus of anything outside of yourself and your own suffering. It just pulls it all into this black hole of despair. And Naomi was missing many of the blessings she had. Because of her bitterness, she wasn't thinking about the great blessing she had in Ruth coming with her. She wasn't completely without family. Ruth sacrificed everything to be with her and provide for her. And in fact, as we're going to see later, God provides for Naomi, delivers Naomi out of this problem through Ruth. So Ruth was a great blessing, but she's not really seeing that right now in the midst of her bitterness, in the midst of her suffering. And she was forgetting the fact that she was able to come home and that Israel was no longer cursed with famine. God in his mercy had blessed at least the Bethlehem area with food and with crops. She was forgetting about the fact that she was healthy despite the death of her husband and son. She still had life. God still had work for her to do, but she wasn't focused on any of those blessings because of her bitterness. And so when we become bitter, that happens to us too. We start focusing just on our suffering, and we forget about all the blessings that God has given us despite our suffering, despite whatever it is that's causing us hardship in life. So we must not let bitterness overthrow our lives. Why? Why must we not do that? Well, this is our second point, because God is at work. God is at work in our suffering. When we face tragedy and trials, we always need to remember that God is at work. Look with me at Ruth 2, 1 through 3, and we'll see the beginning of God's workings in the story of Naomi and Ruth. Ruth chapter 2, verses 1 through 3. It says, "Now Naomi had a relative of her husband's, a worthy man of the clan of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. And Ruth the Moabite said to Naomi, 'Let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain after him in whose sight I shall find favor.' And she said to her, 'Go, my daughter.' So she set out and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers, and she happened to come to the part of the field that belonged to Boaz, who is of the clan of Elimelech." So right away, we see hints of God working. Now we'll get more into what God does specifically starting next week, but God is starting to work. The wheels are starting to move here. There's a man named Boaz who was related to Elimelech. This is an important relative. There's an important family here who's going to play a key role in delivering Naomi and Ruth out of this bitter, this grief-filled situation that they're in. Not only that, but Ruth decides to go glean in the fields wherever she's able. Now, some background here. It might seem strange to you that she's able to do this, because if I'm hungry, or you know, I decide I need some corn or some soybeans or something, I can't go down to Wagner Farms and just start taking crops, right? I can't just start cutting down corn. I can't start just grabbing beans out of the field and taking them home, because even though it's outside, that doesn't mean it's public property, right? That would be stealing. That would be wrong for me to do. So how is she able to do this? How is this not stealing? So look with me at Leviticus 19, verses 9 through 10. We're going to see some laws and how God provided in the Mosaic covenant, the Old Testament covenant that Israel was to live by, we'll see some laws that he gave to provide for the poor and how this worked. Leviticus 19, 9 through 10 says, "When you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not reap your field right up to the edge, neither shall you gather the gleanings after your harvest. And you shall not strip your vineyard bare, neither shall you gather the fallen grapes of your vineyard. You shall leave them for the poor and for the sojourner. I am the Lord your God." And then flip with me to Deuteronomy chapter 28, or 24 rather, I'm sorry. Deuteronomy 24, 19 through 22. Deuteronomy 24, 19 through 22. It says, "When you reap your harvest in your field and forget a sheaf in the field, you shall not go back to get it. It shall be for the sojourner, the fatherless, and the widow, that the Lord your God may bless you in all the work of your hands. When you beat your olive trees, you shall not go over them again. It shall be for the sojourner, the fatherless, and the widow. When you gather the grapes of your vineyard, you shall not strip it afterward. It shall be for the sojourner, the fatherless, and the widow. You shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt. Therefore, I command you to do this." So in these passages, you have in the law of Moses provisions for the poor. So what would happen is at harvest time, you weren't to harvest to the very edges of your field. So you don't harvest absolutely everything. You leave some of the edges unharvested. So the poor and the widow and the sojourner, so the immigrants in today's terms, could come and gather that stuff. Or if you dropped a sheaf, it fell out and it was on the ground, you were to leave it so that the poor could come and collect it. So what would happen is you'd have people who were poor, who were sojourners, who would come along after the harvesters and would pick up any sheaves that were left over, anything that fell on the ground. They would harvest what wasn't harvested after the harvest was completed. And so that's how Ruth is able to do this. This was part of the Mosaic law and how God provided for the poor in society at this time, because there was no social welfare. The government wouldn't give people, you know, at the time of Judges, it wasn't, oh, you're poor, you're under a certain income level, here's some money, here's food stamps. They didn't have any of that. If you were poor, you had to figure it out on your own. And so God, in his law, provided for the poor and the widow and the fatherless and the immigrants by providing this way, by making these laws and these standards for harvest time. So anyway, that's how Ruth is able to do that. So lo and behold, Ruth, she's going out and she's going to just find a field that seems good to her, where she seems that people will allow her to harvest, where it looks like the crop is good. And lo and behold, our text says she happened to come to the part of the field that Boaz, her father-in-law's relative, owned. And so the suggestion here is this happened by chance, that Ruth just luckily came to this field. Now, it's not that the author here of Ruth believes that luck had anything to do with it. They know that God is completely sovereign, that God is in control, that he's orchestrating all of this and orchestrated Ruth's coming to this exact field owned by this exact person, Boaz, in order to deliver her, in order to do all the things that we're going to see in the next couple of weeks. But from Ruth and Naomi's perspective, it wasn't planned. They didn't see, okay, let's see who owns this field. Let's try to get in with a relative or somebody that will treat you favorably. She just came to this field and it happened to be Boaz's field. So God is starting to provide here. The wheels are working. The salvation plan for Ruth and Naomi is moving along. So I want to focus here on how God was providing. So Naomi was full of bitterness and despair because of the death of her husband and sons, and she was just completely without hope at this time. But God was at work. At her darkest moment, God was at work turning things around. He was providing for things. He was starting to put pieces together for her deliverance. And Naomi and Ruth, both of them at this point, have no clue this is going on. Ruth until Naomi tells her, we'll get into this next week, has no idea that Boaz is even related, can even deliver them in the way that he does. There's no clue. All of this is God working for them. So God was at work in their lives. And God is always at work in our lives too. So we may be facing a trial, we may be facing a tragedy, we may be facing an illness, we may be facing grief. And if you've not suffered those things, you're not suffering those things now, it's going to come. Unless the Lord comes back during our lifetime, all of us are at least going to face death at some point. That's usually not a fun process. And so tragedy comes, trials come in our lives. And when they come, God is still at work. It's not that when a trial comes, God has decided, well, okay, hands off this person's life. I'm done working in their life. I have no more use for them. I'm out of here, or God's sleeping or something. God is always at work, even in the midst of trial, even in the midst of adversity, even in the midst of our worst day of our lives, God is there and God is at work in the midst of it. It may not be that God is at work to alleviate all of our suffering or make everything go away. It may not be that God is at work to make us comfortable or for our own comfort, but when God is at work, because God is perfectly good, everything that he's doing is good. So it's good work that God is doing. It may be for the good of other people, which may not be for our own comfort or for our own benefit, but God is at work, and that is good, and we need to remember that. And because of that, this is our third point, we need to take hope, because God hasn't abandoned us. When we are facing trial, when we are facing adversity, when we've lost everything, God hasn't abandoned us. God is at work. God is still on his throne, and he's still working for good. So we shouldn't give up in the throes of bitterness when we face trial, when we face hardship, when we've lost everything like Ruth and Naomi. And we need to look to the example of Ruth. So Ruth didn't give up in despair, but she worked to provide for her family. Ruth is suffering as much, if not more, even than Naomi. Because remember what Ruth has given up. She's lost her husband. She's moved with Naomi all the way to the land of Israel, which is a foreign land for her, where she could face discrimination, where she could face hardship because she is a Moabite. And just look through when you're reading through Ruth, what we've read so far, and then if you read through the story of Ruth or read along with us in the coming weeks, how often it's mentioned that she's a Moabite. The author of Ruth wants to make it very clear that she's a Moabite. Everybody else in the story knows that she's a Moabite, and that could affect her negatively. So Ruth has lost everything, and she's young. So Naomi is older. She can't have children. Ruth has pledged herself to Naomi, and that means that she may never get married. She may never have children. She might have to be the breadwinner for she and her mother-in-law for the rest of her life in a foreign land where she knows nothing, nobody, and she's given up a lot of things. She's suffering. She's grief-stricken. She is in a position of hardship as well, yet she doesn't give up. She doesn't just mope around. She doesn't have everybody call her bitter. She doesn't have everybody bemoan her tragedy. She goes out and she does what she can to provide for the family. She goes and she goes to work, and God ends up delivering the family through her. She tried to do something about it, and she made the most of what God had given to her in a tragic situation. And so we also, when we face tragedy, we need to take hope and we need to keep living. When we face adversity, we've got to keep going. We can't get sucked into that black hole of bitterness that sucks all of our joy, where we're so focused on our pain, when we're so focused on our hardship that we forget about the blessings that God has given to us, that we're ignorant or we're not seeing the work that God has for us to do that could be a blessing to others, even in spite of our suffering. Maybe because of our suffering, we can minister to others in a special way. Warren Wiersbe had a good quote that I think is a good reminder for us when suffering. He said that God's purpose in providence is not to make us comfortable, but to make us conformable, conformed to the image of his son. And so God was conforming Ruth and Naomi, especially through Ruth in this process, into his own image. He was conforming them. And he was blessing, ultimately, all of Israel, and all of us, by extension, are blessed through the story of Ruth and Naomi. And yet, they could have missed all of that if they were just focused on their own pain and their own suffering and their own bitterness. And so we, in our own lives, we need to remember that in the midst of our suffering, God is working. God is conforming us into the image of his son. And there are things for us to do. There are blessings for us to focus on. And if we give in to bitterness, we're going to miss all of that. We're just going to be suffering, and there's going to be little to no fruit coming from it. So we need to take hope in our tragedy because God's at work. He's with us. He's not abandoned us. Now, when hardship and tragedy hit us, we're tempted to become bitter. And it's normal and right to suffer and mourn and grieve. Lamentation is a real thing in Scripture. So I'm not saying by all of this, if something really bad happens or you suffer a loss and you want to grieve, that you just have to be happy, happy, happy because Christians are supposed to be happy, happy, happy. That's not the way it is. Christians grieve, they lament, they endure pain, and it's okay to hurt and suffer. But in the midst of that suffering, don't leave it there. Don't just focus on your suffering and your pain because that leads to bitterness. You need to remember that God is at work in your life. He's not abandoned us. He's doing good things. We need to be looking for those things. We need to be looking for ways that we can serve despite our suffering, or maybe even because of our suffering. We need to look for the blessings that God has given to us, and we need to keep living. So we need to make the most of our opportunities, and we need to make sure that we allow God to conform us into his image in the midst of our suffering, and not become bitter and resentful at life and be like that person that I told you about, my librarian when I was in high school, that just anybody and everybody you're giving a hard time to, and you're bitter and you're frustrated and you're angry at everything and you're depressed and you're not accepting the blessings that God has given to you in your life. We need to be conformed and allow ourselves to be conformed. We need to serve the Lord even in spite of our suffering. Let's close in prayer.